Thank
Okay,
you.
so hi
Thank
again,
you.
everyone. I'm Shoshana, if you missed the introduction. Thanks so much for having me. It's an honor to be here. So I'd like to make this year like a little more interactive, especially because it's a small group, so feel free to just like jump in with questions or comments, and I might ask you for some ideas, so feel free to participate. So I'm going to start off by reading the first pasuk of last week's parsha. I know like last week's parsha is cheating a little bit, but I hope you'll all just bear with me anyway. So it started off, Ki tisat rosh b'nei Yisrael v'pkudehem, v'natnu ish kofer nafsho la'Hashem b'fkodotam, v'lo yihya b'hem nega b'fkodotam. When you take a census of the Israelites according to their numbers, each man should give an atonement for his soul to God when you count them, and there will not be a plague when you count them. V'zeh yitnu, kol ha'over al ha'pikudim, machatzit ha'shekel v'shekel ha'kodesh. And this they should give, everyone who goes through the counting, half a shekel of the holy shekel. So this is a mitzvah that I've known about for a long time in the form of when I was in elementary school, people would, when you were like going to count how many people were in the classroom, you'd be like, not one, not two, not three. And no one really knew why we did that. It was just kind of like a thing. And people told you you weren't from if you weren't doing that. And also, if you're counting a minion, you go like Hoshia at Amecha or Baruch Atah Hashem Motzi Lechem Min Haaretz, things like that. So it's kind of like a strange mitzvah. But the way it's interpreted by most commentators is that it means whenever someone goes to count the Jewish people, you can't count them directly. And specifically here, everybody has to bring a half a shekel, give the half a shekel. And then Moshe, or whoever's doing the census, counts the shekels. And that's how you do a census of the Jewish people. But you're not allowed to count them directly. And it tells us that, like, it says you should do this so that there won't be a plague. So that's, like, a little strange, because why would there be a plague if you count the Jewish people directly? I didn't really understand what that meant. So if we look at Rashi, he explains, "V'lo yihya b'hem negaf, and there will not be a plague. Shehaminyan shalit bo ayin hara, v'hadever ba'alehem. For counting causes the evil eye to affect them, and plague will strike them. Kimoshe matzinu b'yamei David, as we find in the days of David." So, I guess this kind of explained a little bit. Somehow the plague is caused by this ayin hara, but I don't know, that's still, I don't really understand what the ayin hara is, what that has to do with counting, why that would cause a plague, so it didn't really help me. So I guess the way we'll try to resolve this is to figure out what is the ayin hara, and then why it's coming into play here, and then what's going on. So let's start off with talking about the ayin hara. What do you guys know about the ayin hara? What is it? What does it do? What is it? Anybody have any thoughts?
And then I do believe in it.
Okay.
My mother was such a believer. She never let me wear, you know, one of those necklaces with children or grandchildren. No one should count. That was her thing. Also, how old are you? You don't count the years. You know, I'm still 29. Is it more of older people that have these superstitions, or do you think they're still carried on?
Well, I think, like, I mean, it's obviously kind of a superstitious thing, so I think just
I think
kind of people who are more superstitious are more
the red string, the, you know.
Yeah, but people definitely, I definitely know people who, like, very much believe in all this stuff.
I don't know why, I don't know, maybe it was something I learned at some point, but I always think, I think about it more in terms of jealousy, the not provoking jealousy.
Exactly, she's right.
Yes, that's what we'll get to you soon.
You know, and I'm thinking, as I said to her, I teach little ones, I said, I can't tell you how many times I have to count them. And I'm counting them because if I had to change the you know, because there's different numbers each time. You know, so I would never get the pasuk right. Seriously, I would lose again.
Yeah.
I think it's what you said earlier about causing jealousy to those who don't have, for example. Like, that's how we were brought up. Like, you know, you have to be sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
That you have something that someone else doesn't, don't make them feel bad. So don't throw it in their face. That kind of thing. That's how we were raised.
Yes, you guys are already at the punchline of where we're going to get to soon, so this is great. Okay, so in source 2, I'll just read like a little paragraph that I found on the internet about the ayin hara. So we're just like on the same page about what the traditional understanding of it is. The evil eye, ayin hara, is often defined as the ability to bring about evil results by a malicious gaze. In most cultures, a belief is prevalent that some human beings have the power of sending destructive rays, so to speak, in order to cause harm to those of whom they are envious or otherwise dislike. Especially in the Babylonian Talmud, the notion developed that some persons do have this kind of baneful power, and there are a number of superstitious practices to ward off the harmful effects of the evil eye. For example, spitting out 3 times when a person seems to be at risk. Even today, some people, when praising others, will add, "Let it be without the evil eye," in the Yiddish form, "kinayin hara," meaning, "I do not intend my praise to suggest that I am enviously casting a malevolent gaze." So, according to many streams of Jewish thought, including the Ramban, Kabbalists, we could kind of stop here with our explanation of this pasuk from before. The evil eye is some kind of mystical power, comes about when you count people. Great, okay, so that's why there's a plague. Somebody's gonna send a malicious gaze at somebody else while they're counting, and that'll cause a plague. But there's also another stream of Jewish thought, which doesn't put so much stock in these kind of superstitious beliefs, which is the Rambam. And I'll read a little excerpt from the Rambam, which shows you a little bit how he feels about such things like the ayin hara. "All the above matters are falsehood and lies, with which the original idolaters deceived the Gentile nations in order to lead them after them. It is not fitting for the Jews, who are wise sages, to be drawn into such emptiness, nor to consider that they have any value. As implied by Numbers 23:23, no black magic can be found among Jacob or occult arts within Israel. Similarly, Deuteronomy states, 'These nations which you are driving out, listen to astrologers and diviners. This is not what God has granted you. Whoever believes in occult arts of this nature, and in his heart thinks that they are true and words of wisdom, but are forbidden by the Torah, is foolish and feeble-minded. He is considered like women and children who have underdeveloped intellects. The matters of wisdom and those of perfect knowledge know of clear proof that all these crafts which the Torah forbade are not reflections of wisdom, but rather emptiness and vanity, which attracted the feeble-minded and caused them to abandon all paths of truth."
That's why they call them wise cats. Mm-hmm. Women, you know.
"For these reasons, when the Torah warned against all these empty matters, it advised, 'Be of perfect faith with God, your Lord.'" So I was brought up kind of in accordance with this stream of Jewish philosophy. In fact, I have a particular connection with this particular excerpt from the Rambam. When I was in third grade, we learned in school, we were learning about the Makot and Egypt and the Egyptian magician that would try to replicate the plagues to prove to Paro that they weren't real. And our teacher taught us that magic used to be real in the times of the Torah. And I thought that was the coolest thing I'd ever heard in my life, because I was a little third grader who loved fantasy books. So I went home and I told my father, I was like, "Ava, you'll never guess what I learned in school today. Did you know that magic used to be real?" And he was like, "Shoshana, we don't believe in that." And he sat me down and read me this Rambam. And I was like, "Okay, I guess I don't believe in magic." So with that in mind, there are two very valid ways of thinking about these things. But to me, I was interested in trying to understand what this ayin hara business is all about. Following the stream of Judaism of the Rambam and others like him who don't believe in superstition and don't believe in mystical forces in the universe outside of God. So I think that if we try to look at some sources about ayin hara, maybe what we can do is try to like figure out the rules of ayin hara, what it affects, what it doesn't affect, some of those things, and maybe use those things to create a deeper picture of what the ayin hara is all about. So we'll start with the Yosef story. Actually, these kind of are all in the Yosef story. The Yosef story, for some reason, is like has all this stuff about ayin hara.
He's the only one who's protected from ayin hara.
Yeah.
So
just like there's tons and tons of discussion in all the Sukkim about the Yosef story about ayin hara. It's interesting. So the first one is, "Vayavo b'nei Yisrael l'shpor b'toch habayim, ki haya hara v'eretz Kanaan. And the children of Israel came to buy grain amongst those who were coming, for there was a famine in the land of Canaan." So this is Yosef is already down in Egypt. He's been made viceroy. They found out that there's going to be a famine. He's engineered this great system of stockpiling food so that Egypt will be supplied with food for the 7 years of famine. But none of the surrounding nations knew about it. So all of them have to come down to Egypt to buy food, including his brothers. So they're coming down to buy food. And the pasuk says they came down amongst those who were coming. So Rashi, on these kind of extra words, like, of course they were coming amongst those who were coming, like, what does that mean? So Rashi explains, Matmini atzman shelo yakirum. They hid themselves so that they wouldn't be recognized. Lefi shetziva lahem avihem shelo yitra'u kulam bepetach echad, ela sheyichanes kol echad bepitcho, kidei shelo tishaleh behem ayin hara, shekulam na'im bekulam giborim. So, because their father commanded them that they should not all be seen in one entrance. Rather, they should each enter through a separate entrance so that the evil eye should not have power over them, for they are all handsome and they are all strong. So what do you guys think from this specific example of how Ayin Hara comes into effect about like what it affects, what it might not affect, what's going on? Anybody have any thoughts?
Does it go even further back when, I remember learning this when I was a kid, that Yaakov told his sons, go down to Egypt, even though we have, you know, we're not lacking food, because you don't want others to think that, you know, we're starving.
That might be true also.
Yes.
I in no way gathered all of the examples of Ayin Hara. Mm-hmm. This was just one of them. But that might be true also.
The, you know,
yeah.
Don't stand out. You know.
Yeah, so it's about
this.
It's
no
out.
Longer related to counting anymore. This is
right.
An Ayin Hara that has nothing to do with specific numbers. Or
right,
counting.
It has nothing
but
to do with specific numbers.
But it sounds like if they went down together, they might not be handsome or strong afterwards. Like that would be punished. But if the evil eye would get the handsome and strong part.
Oh, interesting.
Maybe it's the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're handsome and strong, the Egyptians will look at them and they say,
mm-hmm.
Well, they may be dangerous for us. We may encounter danger from them, so we should look at these 10 people.
Yeah,
because
that was
if they're together, trouble is going to happen. It's like when you see on the Western movies,
also
like you see like
home.
These guys,
yeah.
They're like,
right, yeah.
These guys are troublemakers.
He had
10
sons that were coming down, you know. Again, that harkens back to what I was taught. Like, not everyone has the blessing of a large family, so don't, you know, shove it in people's faces. Like, you know, go separately.
Yeah, exactly. So we see it's about standing out from the crowd,
mm-hmm.
and kind of, yeah, and it has nothing to do with counting anymore, it seems, although it has to do with them all being seen together.
And again, it doesn't sound like it's some evil eye that's some mystical, superstitious thing. It's other people's eyes, like,
right.
Literally, like,
right.
Don't elicit other people to stare at you and be like, wow, who are these nice-looking, strong guys coming in? You know, that's, you know,
yeah.
It's not really some, that's why I don't really see that part of superstitious. I also grew up, like, with parents looking at my heart and don't do this and the spitting and everything. But it's like, you could, you know, this part about jealousy still resonates with me, but I'm not going to go crazy when I see the black cat. I mean, other things got wrapped up into it, I think, that I don't think are supposed to be part of it. You know, he just took the whole package, and with the 13 and the cats, like, there's nothing to do with it. But, you know, part where other people's feelings and, you know, can be provoked by your actions, that part I can just accept.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's move on to the next one. Okay, so this one has a pretty famous pasuk in it that many people say every night before going to sleep. V'yabarech at Yosef v'yomar ha'elokim asher hitalchu avotai lefanav Avraham v'Yitzchak ha'elokim haro'eh oti me'odi ad hayom hazeh ha'malach ha'goel oti mikora yivarech et ha'ne'arim v'karei behem shimi v'shem avotai Avraham v'Yitzchak v'yidgu l'rov v'karev ha'aretz. And he blessed Yosef and said, the God whom my ancestors Avraham and Yitzchak walked before, the God who shepherded me from them until this very day, the angel that redeemed me from all evil, shall bless the boys, and call them in my name and the name of my ancestors, Abraham and Yitzchak, and they should be like the many fish in the midst of the land. So this is Yaakov's blessing to his son Yosef and Yosef's children and their future generations. And their blessing is that they should be like the many fish in the midst of the land. So that's kind of a weird bracha. What does that mean? So Rashi explains, "Ki dagim halalu sheparim v'rabim ve'ein ayin hara shalatet b'hem," like the fish that are fruitful and multiply, and the evil eye has no power over them. So we see that there's some reason why fish are not affected by the Ayin Hara, and Yaakov is blessing Yosef's descendants that they should also not have the Ayin Hara have power over them.
Hidden things.
Yeah.
Things that you can see, hidden things. No one knows, so no one can jealous or can like put his Ayin Hara on it.
Yeah, exactly. So if we look at the next source, if we just look at the bolded part, explains exactly that. So this is the Gemara that Rashi's getting that from, which just gives us a little bit more insight into what fish have to do with the Ayin Hara. It says, V'yigulur of Bekerif Aretz, Madagim Shabayam Mayim Mechasin Alehem, V'ein Ayin Hara Shaletet Bahem, Av Zaro Shal Yosef, V'ein Ayin Hara Shaletet Bahem. May they multiply in the midst of the earth, just as a fish in the sea, water covers them, and the evil eye has no dominion over them, so too the seed of Yosef, the evil eye has no dominion over them. Yes, yeah, so as you were saying, the fish are covered by the water, so you can't see them, so there's no Ayin Hara.
Is anybody else like any? Saying, like, "En ha-bracha shorah, ela bedavar ha-samui min ha-ayin." The blessing is, like, happens only for things that are covered, that people don't see. I don't recall where I can Google it.
Cool, thank you. Does anybody else have any other thoughts about this part? What else might be going on here?
Yeah, from Baba Metzia it says. Baba Metzia the Gemara says, "Ena davar, ena bracha shura, ela bedavar samui min ha'ayin."
Samui?
Samui means like hidden.
What's
hidden? Sorry?
How do you spell it?
Samech Nam Vav Yud.
Thank you. I
didn't
hear that one before.
Like a blind person.
Okay.
Isn't
yeah,
it,
so.
Isn't a blind person from that same church?
Blind? Yes. Sumach.
Sumach.
Right.
Yes.
Yes, you're right.
Yeah, I think that's maybe another aspect of it. So,
so
there are.
Right?
Right.
So is this like the same?
Yes.
Okay, right. I can't. No,
you're right.
Yeah, so another aspect of it might be the multitude of the fish. So there are many, many fish, and yet they're covered so there won't be an Ayin Hara. So we see some of these themes coming back from before. So counting multitudes, not standing out. Okay.
Also, there are so many fish, it's hard to count them.
Put in somewhere too.
Their own movement, so it's really hard to count
them.
Like
your kid. Okay. So now if you look at this full Gemara, it actually contains a bunch of different things about this idea of the children of Yosef not having the Ayin Hara have power over them. Okay, so we'll start from the beginning. Rabbi Yochanan hava ragil dehava ka'aziel v'yatev ashari detvila. Rabbi Yochanan was accustomed to go and sit at the gates of the women's immersion sites. Amar, ki salkan beno Yisrael v'atiyan mitvila mistaklin bi, v'nehave lehu zara d'shvire kavasi. When the daughters of Israel emerge from their immersion, they will look at me, and they will have children as beautiful as I. Rabbi Yochanan was known for his good looks. Okay, so that's kind of weird in and of itself.
Very
we're not going to discuss that.
Today you will be arrested.
It's just not working outside the
mikvah.
Of course, it's how scientific it is. She looks at him. If the girl looks at him,
right. So there's probably lots that could be said about this part of it. Anyway, so we'll focus on the next part. The sages asked him, "Master, do you not fear the evil eye?" He said to them, "I descend from the seed of Yosef, over whom the evil eye has no dominion. As it is written, Yosef is a..." Oh, sorry, I was reading Hebrew, I forgot. Okay. Amar le Rabbanan, lo kamis misate mar me nebisha. Master, do you not fear the evil eye? Amar lehu, he said to them, "Ana mizara di Yosef, ka'atina, lo shalte be enabisha. I descend from the seed of Yosef, over whom the evil eye has no dominion. Dichtiv ben parat Yosef, ben parat alei ayin. Yosef is a bountiful vine on a spring. Alei ayin being on a spring. Va'amar Rabbi Abahu, al tikri alei ayin, ela ole ayin. Don't read it on a spring, but rather over the eye, meaning like transcending the influence of the evil eye. Okay, so then we had the other pasuk, that we just quoted before, the source being that it's Higula Rokatera Karetz, fish, etc. And then the third one, the Ibait Ema, Ayan Shalo Rats Talazun, Mimasha Eno Shalo, Ein Ayan Hara Shaleteko. Alternatively, Yosef's eye, which did not seek to feast on that which was not his, Potiphar's wife, the evil eye has no dominion over him. Okay, so does anybody have any thoughts about either of the other two sources for what, for why the children of Yosef don't have the Ayan Hara had influence over them?
Concept of in other words, if we have a concept that every person has a is allotted what they're supposed to have, then there's no room for somebody, you know, in an ideal world, if everybody accepts the fact that what's there, you know, I might have more money, this one might have more intelligence, this one might have some more whatever, then I don't have an evil eye against that person for having something that I don't have, because I accept that they're supposed to have that, and that accomplishes their mission in Avodas Hashem, and I'm given the tools that I'm given to do Avodas Hashem, so then there's no use of an evil eye, if you understand that, you know, you're not asking for something that's not supposed to be yours.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Seems like it comes from the Tachmon.
But that last part of, like, the fact that they're saying that because he did not seek to feast, so he didn't get the evil eye, that's very different than just someone being counted or somebody going out with a lot of children. Because you have to assume the inverse, right? So somebody who does feast, then if somebody feasts on something which does not belong to him, then he will elicit the evil eye, which is an active thing that you're actually doing. Like, you're again, having that evil eye on somebody else, and you're bringing it back to you. But the first part, like what you saw in the beginning, of just being counted or just going out as a group, you're not really doing anything, and yet you're still eliciting the evil eye. So it is different. You know, one is more passive than the other. So
yeah, so we're seeing kind of a different side of the Ayan Hara, where it's something that you're actually doing as opposed to something happening.
Well, it sounds like this is more like a zechus that Yosef's children now have, because Yosef didn't want something that wasn't his, so now
his children like the opposite from.
Right. It's like something that,
I don't know if it's going to say just that it's his chus, but I would say that if that's
the
nature of Yosef and his progeny, then that's the nature of, you know, accepting not just that he did that and it's his chus and a reward for him, but that it doesn't, the natural consequence of accepting your own and not trying to...
I mean, they're following Yosef's footsteps.
Right.
They're,
right.
They're,
like
they have the same needs.
They
have the same needs.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, but I almost feel that's negative on the rest of us.
The rest of us.
The rest of the sons.
I mean, the other shvatim.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, so if you're saying he did something good, and so he merited it, it sounds like a positive, where the other one is like...
But they're not children.
But it makes sense,
yeah.
Given the history of Yosef and his brothers, he was the object of the jealousy, right? So they were all kind of jealous of him. So it would make
Benjamin
sense.
Benjamin too.
I mean, from the beginning, that
what
he was the object of affection.
But it also could be like his behavior with not looking at, you know, I guess they're talking here about looking at Potiphar.
Right.
Yeah.
So that could be like a tikkun for what he did in the beginning of his life, which was more flaunting his specialness.
Yeah,
so
that's
like he,
really,
you know, what?
That's really interesting. I never thought of that before.
So
but that really could be
his,
what's going on. Like he was kind of this
he was kind
object
of
jealousy
that.
And flaunting himself, and then he
kind
of changed his whole life around. That's really interesting. Okay. So those were a number of sources from the Gemara and from Rashi. These are all later sources in Jewish tradition. Rashi living in the 11th century to the beginning of the 12th century, the Gemara being completed around 500 CE. But if we go back to the Mishnah, which, you know, was completed by Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi in 200 CE, so like 300 years earlier, and actually most things in the Mishnah are actually from from way before that, from like before the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash in year 70, we'll see it's a little bit different. So if we start with Pirkei Avot, okay, so this is Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, gives this challenge to his students. Amar lahem, tsu'u ru'u, ezuhi darethi shara, shiyadakba ha'adam. Go out and see which is the straight path to which a person should cling. Rabbi Eliezer omer, ayin tova. Rabbi Eliezer said, goodbye. And then all the other students say some other things, being a good friend, being a good neighbor, etc. But Rabbi Eliezer said, having a good eye. Amar lahem, tsu'u ru'u, ezuhi darech ra'a, shiyitrachik mimena ha'adam. Go out and see which is the evil path which a person should distance himself from. Rabbi Eliezer omer, ayin ra'a. And Rabbi Eliezer said, an evil eye. So now it seems like an evil eye is not any kind of mystical force at all, but rather some kind of character trait or lifestyle that Rabbi Eliezer says is the most important thing in the world to avoid. Okay, so Bartanura, who's a commentator on the Mishnah, says, Ayin Tova, this is how he defines it, Mistapek Umashi Yishlo, he is satisfied with what he has, the Enom Evocation of Arnim Yeterim, does not seek extra things, the Enom Mekane Kesharo Ash Yishlo Chavera Yeterim Manu, and he's not jealous when he sees that his friend has more than him. Okay, so now let's jump into the second Mishnah. This is a Mishnah in Trumot. Truma is when you have your produce, you have to take a certain amount, you have to take some of it and give it to the Kohen. The Torah doesn't specify how much truma you could take. Any small amount of truma would satisfy the requirement according to the Torah. But the rabbis established some like guidelines for how much truma you should take. And these are them. Shear truma. What is the measurement of truma? Ayin yafeh, if you have a good eye, achad mar arba'in, you should take 1/40. Beit Shammai omrin mishloshim, and Beit Shammai say it's 1/30. The Habenoni, if you have a medium eye, mishamishim, 1/50. The Hara'a, if you have an evil eye, mishishim, 1/60. So, okay, from these two Mishnayot, we can see that they're using a completely different definition of ayin hara than we saw before. Does anybody want to talk about a little bit what you think it is?
Generous,
cheapskate. Yeah, exactly. Like, if you don't want to give so much of your truma to the Kohen, then you give 1/60. Obviously, yeah, it's saying, talking about being stingy, which is the exact opposite of what the Bartanura defined as having an ayin tova, being satisfied with what you have, not seeking extra things, not being jealous. So, kind of from all these sources together, we can see that an ayin hara, or ayin ra, that is a character trait that refers to someone who is stingy, ungracious, trying to have more than everyone else, who gets extremely jealous if someone has more than him, who is bothered greatly when good things happen to other people. And according to Rabbi Eliezer, it's like the most terrible character trait in the entire world that you have to like be very, very careful to avoid. And we have to do all we can to have the opposite of that character trait. So if we go back and think about the definition of ayin hara as it's used by Rashi and in the Gemara, we see that what they're actually doing is telling us to go a step beyond what Rabbi Eliezer is saying. It's not enough to just avoid being jealous of other people and having that character trait yourself, but as a lot of you were saying before, it's kind of an imperative to avoid provoking that in other people. And we need to kind of recognize that in the world, other people maybe aren't as refined and developed as we might like to be, and are jealous and stingy, and will resent you if you come across as wealthy, powerful, confident. So it's not a mystical force at all. It's a psychological reality that the world is full of people that are jealous and envious of others, and we have to take it upon ourselves to avoid provoking anger and jealousy from others toward ourselves, and to conduct ourselves with modesty and humility. So if we go back to what we were talking about at the beginning, let's just go backwards a little bit. So as we saw in these sources about Yosef, they were all about the ayin hara doesn't affect things that are concealed, doesn't affect things that don't stand out. The way you provoke ayin hara is by standing out, by provoking jealousy, and if you're hidden and concealed, you don't have any Ayanhara affect you. So if we go all the way back to the beginning, when we were talking about the senses, so what's going on there? Why would counting provoke the Ayanhara, and how is it that we avoid it? So counting a nation, is for determining how powerful the nation is. The censuses we take in the Torah are always counting from the ages 20 to 60. Those are the people that are going to the army. We're trying to figure out how powerful our army is. So if you're taking a census, you're saying, wow, we have, you know, 800,000 soldiers, or whatever the number was in this parsha, that's showing up, that's flaunting our strength. So in order to temper this, what does the Torah tell us to do? The Torah tells us to have a kofar nafsho, for each person to take an atonement of his soul. So what does that do? So we have to take an atonement for our soul. So we're actually just countering the flamboyance and haughtiness that taking a census might provoke with the opposite. Taking an atonement for your soul, you're saying, like, you're thinking, an atonement involves doing tshuva. You have to think about yourself. Like, you're, when we talk about kapara, it's often like when we bring a korban as a kapara, we are saying that this animal, like, is sacrificed instead of ourselves. Like, we're thinking about humility, and we're doing tshuva. So by giving a half of a shekel instead of ourselves, we're developing a sense of humility, which will counteract the haughtiness that the census provokes.
I think they're supposed to provoke haughtiness
from other nations, and even from ourselves. So giving a shekel, so it says that it's a kofar nafsham, so it's an atonement for your soul, and you're giving this shekel to the Mishkan. That was what they used these shekelim for. In the parsha here, they used them to build the sockets for the pillars to hold the Mishkan. And in future years, they became the tradition to do this once a year, which is what we have like a remembrance for that we do on Purim. People like take like 3 half shekels and trade it with $3 coins, whatever. So we're taking something that represents ourselves, and we're giving it to God, and that's kind of symbolically showing that we're not like all about ourselves. It's not about our strength, but it's about like putting ourselves in the service of God. And we're not doing it to show off, but we're doing it to serve God. So it tempers the feeling.
And it's also the fact that it's Machatzit shows that we are connected with the others. So we're not just ourselves. No, which also, I think, tempers the eye in the back.
Yeah, that too. And then also the idea that everybody gives the same amount. These are all things that... Right, they're showing everybody's the same, nobody's greater than anybody else, and then we're all, you know, taking ourselves and representing ourselves in service to God. Okay, so I think that I was supposed to end at 9:15, so I won't do this long part at the end, but I'll do this next part. So if you look at source number 9, we seem to have a contradiction. In the first pasuk in Bamidbar, Moshe is commanded, take a census of the entire congregation of Israelites according to their families, according to their fathers' houses, according to the number of names, every male according to their poles. So the commentators differ on how to understand this pasuk, but it seems like there's no mention of this machatzit hashekel procedure, which we thought we were told in Shemot that is mandatory to avoid provoking a plague. So what's going on here?
This one's not military, right?
And so this one is military.
It is?
This one is military. It's before they're about to go into, they're like counting them to, before they go into the land of Israel to determine how big the army is. Okay, right, so it seems like there's no mention of Machatzit HaShekel. So some commentators, like Rashi, say, like, oh, well, it's not mentioned, but they obviously still did have to take the Machatzit HaShekel. But other commentators point out that, no, it really sounds like the exact opposite. Kol Zachar L'Gulgulotam, what's a gulgulet? A gulgulet is a head. You're counting the people's heads. So how could you say there's a machzita shekel? It's clear that there's not from the pshat of the psukim. So the Abarbanel answers this in accordance with how we've been understanding it before. He says that the count in Parshat Tisisa was an optional count. Moshe didn't have to count the people there. He said, Ki Tisa, when you want to take account of the people. And he explains why Moshe might have wanted to take a census then. It's not our topic. But here, this was commanded by God. So when you're commanded by God to count the people, there's no worry of ayin hara, of you know, promoting this haughty attitude amongst the people of how strong we are, because we're just commanded by God to take a census. The command can nullify any kind of greatness that we feel about ourselves by the census. But in Parshat Ki Tisa, they didn't have to take a census. That then you have to counteract this haughty feeling by doing this machatzit hashakal procedure. So we can see that this whole ayin hara business teaches us that we have to be very careful to conduct ourselves with modesty and humility, and always just see ourselves in as servants of God and not just as and not let our power get to our heads. Does anybody have any other questions?
Still no magic.
Still no magic. Right, so, you know, you could understand it in a mystical way that, like, you know, by promoting this attitude, it'll cause, like, some kind of evil power, but you could also understand it as, you know, any kind of negative effect would be a punishment from God for this attitude and nothing else.
It looks like they moved.
Yes.
The sources.
They all left.
They all left.
So I'm assuming they went to die someplace else.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you want to,
so if you have like, is there anything
okay.
else? Or are you done?
I mean, I don't want to like keep anybody here.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you
so much. If you're curious, the last part was the story that Rashi mentioned at the beginning in the days of David when they did a census and there was a plague. And the Abarbanel has a really interesting understanding of it that is also relevant, so you could all look it up on your own for their study.